Today, Lines in the Sand. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the Property Imperative Weekly to the 16th of February 2019, our digest of the latest finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. The data fest continued this week with more evidence of weakness appearing in the global economy as Italy formally went into recession, Trump declared an emergency to pay for his wall, trade talks progressed, but Brexit continued to wind into chaos, and US retail figures were shockingly weak, a further indicator that the current stock market rally is going to run out of steam. And locally, more banks revealed margin compression, home prices continue to fall, and the property spruikers fixated on the slightly higher auction clearance results this past week, despite their continued weakness. Just another week in paradise. And by the way, if you value the content we produce, please do consider supporting our efforts. You can make a one-off donation via PayPal, here's the link, or consider joining our Patreon program. Again, here is the link. We really appreciate your support to help us continue to make great content. The links are also in the comments below. So first to home prices. The latest index from CoreLogic shows more falls, with Melbourne and Perth dropping at 0.32% and 0.46% respectively this week. Sydney dropped 0.26%. As always, these are only averages, and so they only tell some of the story. But the falls from peak are continuing to grow. Perth is now at 17.1% down, and Sydney at 12.8% down from their previous peaks. The impact of this is a reduction in the number of suburbs with a $1 million price tag. CoreLogic data to the end of January 2019 showed that there were 649 suburbs across Australia that had a median house or unit value of at or in excess of $1 million. They said, although this figure has increased substantially from 123 suburbs a decade earlier, it has fallen from 741 suburbs in January 2018. In fact, more suburbs had a median of at least $1 million in 2017 at 651. Than do currently. And as at January 2019, there were 366 suburbs in New South Wales that had a median house value of at least $1 million, and 46 suburbs with a median unit value of at least $1 million. And in Victoria, there were 129 suburbs that had a median value of at least $1 million at January 2019. This is the negative wealth effect in practice. Australian auction clearance rates jumped noticeably last week, with the final rate in Sydney at 54% and Melbourne at 52.4%, whereas before Christmas we were in the 40s. CoreLogic said that the combined capital city final auction clearance rate remained above 50%, however volumes are still quite low across the capitals, with only 928 auctions held. The last time we saw the final weighted average clearance above 50% was back in late September 2018, when volumes were significantly higher. And a year ago, a higher 1,470 capital city auctions went to auction, returning a final auction clearance rate of 63.7%. And this weekend, CoreLogic is currently tracking 1,359 auctions across the capitals, so the volume is up by 46% from last week, and we'll see how that plays out. But the lower year-on-year trend continues, with volumes down 31.8% when compared to the same time last year. In fact, we often get a small lift after the summer break, so this is, in my view, not material. But the industry is making the most of the higher results and not mentioning the painfully low volumes. Now, this takes us to the question of whether there will be looser lending ahead. Well, ASIC came out this week with their thoughts on responsible lending standards. Specifically, they refer to using the household expenditure measure as a guide, and lenders need to make specific inquiry to confirm affordability, not rely on an HEM without appropriate buffers. So my view is that HEM 2.0 will be used to keep bank costs down, which will keep credit standards much tighter than they were. All this reinforces the focus on tighter lending standards. And remember that APRA recently confirmed the 7% hurdle for affordability rates will stay and warned of risks in the system. And ASIC also benefited from the passage of a bill this week to give the regulator powers to impose more fines. ASIC is baring its teeth. corporate executives could face maximum jail terms of 15 years for criminal offences, and companies could cop fines of up to $525 million per civil violation. We are in a new lending environment, and as you know by now, tighter credit means lower home prices. HSB made the point this week that the deacceleration in the flow of housing credit has been evident since at least early 2018, but has only recently come into focus due to a flurry of weakness in indicators of domestic demand. This includes a weaker than expected quarter three GDP print, the biggest monthly drop in surveyed business conditions since the global financial crisis, a 22.5% year-ending fall in building approvals, and monthly retail sales that turned negative in December, confirming two soft quarters of consumer spending. And they say in the ugly contest of G10 foreign exchange, we still think the Aussie dollar looks unattractive versus the higher carry and reserve currency status of the US dollar. And so our forecast, they say, remains for the Aussie US dollar to trade down to post-crisis lows of 66 cents by year end. And we think it could go even lower than that. And another dampening factor to consider is that according to the AFR, China has introduced jail terms for operators of underground banks, illegally helping tens of thousands of its citizens transfer money out of the country to buy property overseas. This will reinforce the cooling demand that we've already seen from international buyers and will put more pressure on the high-rise developers and our real estate market more broadly. They took this step to try and prop up the weakening Chinese economy, where home sales are falling. Estimates by Gan Li, a professor at Southwestern University of Finance and Economics in Shenzhou, suggest that sales volumes in 24 cities tracked by China Real Estate Index Systems fell by 44% in the first week of 2019, compared with a year earlier. Though the four largest cities, including Shanghai and Beijing, still saw a 12% increase. Roughly 25% of China's gross domestic product has been created from property-related industries, according to CSLA, and housing is a crucial means of asset formation in China, where ordinary citizens face restrictions to overseas investment and have few domestic options besides local stock markets, which lost 25% of their value last year. Professor Gan's striking estimate that 65 million urban residences, or 21.4% of housing, stand unoccupied, was published in a report in December. The proportion is up from 18.4% in 2011, driven by a rise in vacancies in second and third tier cities where demand is relatively weaker and speculative activities are more prevalent. In other words, almost half the bank loans are tied to housing assets that are neither being lived in nor churning out rental income. According to the stress test conducted by the professor, a 5% fall in housing prices would take away 7.8% of the actual asset value of occupied houses, but 12.2% for unoccupied houses. Back in Australia, the broker wars continues, with the industry mounting a rearguard action to try and reverse the Hayne recommendation to remove conflicted remuneration by abolishing commission in favour of a buyer's fee, as well as bringing in a best interest obligation. They are, however, battling uphill, with consumer groups claiming that the mortgage broker industry is pretending to care about reform while vigorously lobbying politicians to protect their commissions. The consumer group said mortgage broking lobbyists continue to swarm on Parliament House in an attempt to derail crucial recommendations from the Royal Commission final report, showing the sector cannot be trusted to stand up for everyday homeowners when it comes to reform. And as reported by SBS, they are urging the government to implement the recommendations of the Royal Commission into the financial services industry, including ending trail commission payments to brokers for the life of a loan and phasing out commissions paid by lenders to brokers who push their loans. And UBS added heat to the debate by reporting that 32% of customers who secured their mortgage via brokers stated their had misrepresented parts of their mortgage documentation, compared to just 22% of customers who used banks' proprietary channels. In each category of factual accuracy, with the exception of would rather not say, there was a statistically significantly higher level of misrepresentation for customers who secured their mortgage via a broker, the report said. And data from New Zealand also shows a weakening housing market there. According to the REINZ, outside of Auckland, seasonally adjusted house prices rose by 2.3% in December, with prices up 9.7% year on year. But Auckland's seasonally adjusted median house price fell 2.4% and was down 2.4% year on year, the second year of falls. Christchurch or Canterbury's fell by 1.7% in January and was down 1.4% year on year, whereas Wellington's median house price rose 0.9% in January, but was up 11.6% year on year. And in other New Zealand news, the Reserve Bank there has gone coy on the next cash rate movement. It might be up, it may be down, as some weaker economic indicators come through. I'll be releasing a report from Joe Wilkes on this tomorrow. And of course, the Reserve Bank in New Zealand has also tabled a proposal to lift bank capital much higher than APRA is proposing. Under the proposals, over 5 years or so, banks' Tier 1 capital ratios would rise from the current industry average of around 12% of risk-weighted assets to somewhere above 16% of banks deemed systemically important. RBNZ Governor Adrian Orr defended the reforms, contending that the proposed capital requirements are not excessive and would lead to a more level playing field in the banking sector. He also attacked the excessive returns of Australia's Big Four banks, as reported in the AFR, saying, "We have to remember that the return on equity should be related to the risk they are taking. At the moment, the return on equity for banking is incredibly strong, and we would even hazard to say over and above the risks they are holding themselves as private banks, because there is an aspect in most OECD countries of the ability to free ride, where returns can be privatized and losses can be socialized. More capital means sounder financial institutions. The capital levels that we are talking about are still well within the range of norms, and we spend a lot of time trying to compare apples with apples." Now, a back of an envelope calculation that I did suggests Australian banks would need an extra $100 billion or so of capital to get to the same level as proposed in New Zealand. So I guess you could call this the price of Australia's too big to fail policy. Taxpayers may yet have to pick up the bill. New Zealand is once again way ahead on policy here. The RBA had a couple of outings this week, but there was little new, still clinging to the wages growth will come mantra, and also making again the point that the Aussie dollar can go lower to support the economy. Despite the evidence, expect a rate cut later. The question now is whether it will be before or after the election, or both. And just when you thought it was safe to come out after the Banking Royal Commission, the Treasurer noted that there will be a further review in 3 years' time to ensure that they've improved their behaviour and are treating customers better. And Josh Frydenberg wrote this week to the heads of the Australian Banking Association, the Australian Securities and Investments Commission, and the Australian Prudential Regulatory Authority, directing them to swiftly implement dozens of Commissioner Haynes' recommendations that pertain to their bodies. This reform is not going away. For a banker's view, see our post Beyond the Royal Commission, where I discuss what the bank should be doing. I discussed it with ex-ANZ director John Dalson. And talking of reform, post the Royal Commission, there was progress on the Glass-Steagall Bill in Parliament this week. The question of structural separation of the banks has been passed to a Senate committee for a review. And here is an extract from Hansard. "The Haynes Royal Commission into misconduct in the banking, superannuation and financial service industry has highlighted the necessity for banks to be limited to their core industry. The vertical integration of the banks providing additional services, including financial advice, insurance and superannuation, have been shown to be the root cause of rorts, overcharging and price gouging." Australia's best-known finance commentator, Alan Kohler, wrote in The Australian on the 3rd of December 2018, and I quote, "I've been opening a random sample of the 10,140 submissions, just short ones from individuals. Without exception, they call for the banks to be broken up, and most of them surprisingly use the term Glass-Steagall, suggesting that the now repealed American law that used to forcibly separate banking from insurance and investment banking be introduced into Australia." And Kohler stated further that would certainly be a fertile field for the Royal Commissioner to plough. Although most of the banks have already announced plans to break themselves up along these lines, so perhaps such a recommendation would lack drama. Unlike most commentators and politicians, however, Kohler is not totally fooled by these moves from the banks that appear as if they're separating voluntarily. Continuing, he made the following very important point, but Westpac says it will keep its insurance and wealth management division, and AMP and Macquarie have not announced any plans to get rid of their banks. So an Australian version of Glass-Steagall would make it uniform and would make sure they didn't slide back into their bad old one-stop shop ways in the future. Kohler now joins the ranks of other notable Australian experts who have endorsed the Glass-Steagall option. In the aftermath of the global financial crisis, Don Argus, former CEO of National Australia Bank and former chairman of BHP, said in The Australian on the 17th of December 2011, and I quote, "People are lashing out and creating all sorts of regulation, but the issue is whether they're creating the right regulation. What has to be done is to separate commercial banking from investment banking." And former ANZ director John Dalson wrote in the Australian Financial Review on the 21st of August 2018, and I quote, "Problems in banking will not be solved until the structure is changed. With barriers removed, it's possible that the banks and the investment market will move to unlock shareholder value in structural separation, following the principle of the US Glass-Steagall Act, which kept commercial and retail banking separate. Voluntary demergers would threaten the gravy train of coupon clipping for fee extraction, but enforced separation in Australia seems inevitable." And former ACCC chairman Professor Alan Fells was quoted in The Australian on the 9th of August 2018, and again I quote, "There are a number of serious structural issues that need to be considered. The first and the most obvious is the separation of the activity of creating financial products and then offering so-called independent advisory services to customers on what are the best products. A second very important one is whether there should be a structural separation between traditional banking activities and the more risky investment activities. Banks benefit from the implicit guarantee on their deposit liabilities, which flows into their trading activities." And banking expert Martin North of Digital Finance Analytics stated in his submission to the interim report of the Royal Commission, "The large players are too big to fail and too complex to manage and need to be broken apart. A modern Glass-Steagall separation would achieve this, and it is proven to reduce risk and drive better customer outcomes and right-size our finance sector." And former APRA principal research Dr. Wilson Tsai recommended in his submission to the Royal Commission, "The financial system should be structurally separated to simplify regulation, increase competition and innovation, and better serve the community." And the Banking System Reform Separation of Banks Bill 2018, previously introduced by the Honourable Bob Katter MP in the House of Representatives, but since lapsed, is being introduced by Pauline Hanson's One Nation Party into the Senate due to, quote, "my party's ongoing commitment to overcome the systemic failure in our banking system and, more importantly, in bank management per se." So, we'll see what happens next. So there was more new data this week when the ABS released the first in its new combined series of Household and Business Finance, 5601. The new data required a rebuild of our analytics, but it's very clear that the rate of growth of new credit continues to ease across the board. The focus of the release is credit flows, the rate of new loans being written. Owner-occupied lending flows fell by 1.59% from November to December, down $310 million. Investment lending fell 1.6%, down $125 million. And personal credit fell 1.17%, down $68 million. Total credit flows to households fell 1.52%, down $506 million. And business credit fell 2.55%, down $866 million. And total credit flows overall dropped by 2.03% to $1.38 billion, or $66.5 billion. The key thing to understand is that the credit impulse, the rate of change of credit growth, continues to ease, which signals a weaker economy and lower home prices ahead. And significantly, owner-occupied lending is slowing faster than investment lending now. And you can watch our video, Down, Down, Lending is Down, where we go through the results in more detail. And we also this week released a couple of updated videos. The first is Should I Buy Now?, where we go through our thinking as to whether it's sensible to buy property at the moment or not. And in short, it depends. And we also published a matching video called Should I Sell Now, where we update our thoughts on whether property owners should consider selling in the current environment. And again, it depends. And if you're looking for some more insightful information on what's happening with regard to our economy, you might want to look at our post, Australia Does Not Have Supernatural Powers. In this post, John Adams and I discuss the theory that Australia is different and therefore will not see an economic crisis, as many argue. And this full show, which is 28 minutes, is available on our In the Interests of the People channel. And so to the markets. The ASX 100 rose just 0.08% on Friday to 4,989.20 and is now up 3.71% over the past year. The local volatility index was up a little to 12.73% and is down 30.09% from a year back as market concerns continue to ease. The ASX 200 financials rose 0.15% on Friday to end at 5,779.80 and is still down 7.58% from a year ago. The banks are a riskier proposition these days as mortgage lending continues to slow. ANZ was up 1.02% to 26.81, down 3.26% from last year. And CBA was up 0.31% to 70.81 and is down 4.33% from this time last year. NAB was down a little to 24.22 and has fallen 16.11% over the past year. They are currently the least trusted bank, according to recent Roy Morgan research, and the recent leadership changes are clearly not helping. Westpac was up 0.19% to 26.24, down 13.8% from a year back, and of course the ASIC HEM case remains unresolved. Bank of Queensland was up 0.3% to 9.95, but down 17.2% from this time last year, and Suncorp, who reported this week with a lower margin and higher costs, including a number of insurance claims events, was up 0.92% to 1310, down 1.65% from last year. Bendigo and Adelaide Bank, who also reported, again with margin down and costs up, was up 0.1% to 987, down 9.38% from this time last year. It's sure tough being a regional bank in a slowing and competitive mortgage environment. AMP, who also reported this week with a significant, if not unsignaled, drop in profit following the Royal Commission, fell 3.11% on Friday to end at 218, down 57.39% from a year ago. I find it hard to know what the true value of this company is, given the remediation challenge ahead. Macquarie, who gave a bullish update, was down 0.98% to 124.22, up 21.42% since last year, and they remain confident of the outlook ahead, helped by their international footprint. Genworth, the lender's mortgage insurer, fell 0.83% to 238, down 8.75% over the year, and Aggregator Mortgage Choice rose 0.63% to 79.5 cents, down 64.44% from last year, as the broker commissions question bites. The Aussie was up 0.11% to 71.47, still down 10.61% from a year ago. More falls ahead, methinks. The Aussie Gold Cross was up 0.16% to 1,850.35, up 8.71% from last year, and the Aussie Bitcoin Cross was down 0.5% to 4,552.1, down 62.69% from a year ago. Now over to the US, where headline nominal retail sales fell by 1.2% over the month, their sharpest monthly decline since the financial crisis. Notwithstanding ongoing strong job creation, consumption weakened on the back of low confidence and market turbulence. Yet Wall Street rallied on Friday, with the Dow and the Nasdaq posting their eighth consecutive weekly gains as investors grew hopeful that the United States and China would hammer out an agreement resolving their protracted trade war. Talks between the United States and China will resume in Washington next week, with both sides saying progress has been made towards resolving the two countries' contentious trade dispute. With just weeks to go until the March 1 deadline, President Donald Trump offered an optimistic update on the second round of US-China trade talks, prompting traders to turn bullish on stocks. Trump said that trade talks are going extremely well, stressing that the United States is closer than ever to having a real trade deal with China. Without a trade deal secured by March 1, the US could implement further tariffs on China, Trump said. However, that he would be honored to remove tariffs if an agreement can be reached. This newfound optimism on trade pushed energy stocks sharply higher, as traders had long feared a prolonged trade war could hurt economic growth in China, the world's largest oil consumer, denting oil demand. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 1.74% to 25,883, up 2.19% from last year. The S&P 500 gained 1.09% to 2,775, up 1.76% on last year. And all 11 major sectors in the S&P 500 ended the session in the black. The S&P 100 was up 1.09% to 1,217.96, up 0.97% from last year. And the volatility index was down 8.08% on Friday to 1491, 15.78% lower than a year back and well off its nervous highs. The S&P Financials Index was down 0.55% to 425.53, still down 11.01% from a year earlier, reflecting concerns about future earnings. Goldman Sachs was up 3.1% to 198.50, still 26.68% lower than last year. The Nasdaq Composite was up 0.61% to 7,472 and is 3.97% higher than this time last year. Apple was down 0.22% to 170.42, up 2% from a year back. Google was down 0.85% to 1,119, up 5.27%, while Amazon was down 0.91% to 1,607.95, up 11.83, after scrapping its plans for a New York headquarters. Facebook was down 0.88% to 162.50, down 8.67% from a year back. Intel was up 1.67% to 51.66 and 11.67% up from last year. The Fed's weaker stance continues to flow through to a lower 10-year Treasury rate, and it was up 0.2% on Friday to 2.664. The three-month rate was also down 0.13% to 2.427. As a result, funding costs are easing a little, taking some of the risk pressure off, but, of course, leaving the US cash rate lower than the Fed would have liked to see. The economy has not escaped the QE bear trap yet. The US index was down a little to 96.92 and is 8.91% higher than a year back. And across the pond, the British pound US dollar was up a little to 1.2897. down 8.61% from a year ago. The UK FTSE was up 0.55% to 7,236 and is slightly lower than a year back, which, given the Brexit uncertainty, says something. Prime Minister May suffered yet another humiliating defeat as Parliament voted against her amendment to seek reaffirmation of support to see changes to her Brexit deal. The vote only slightly raised the risk of a no-deal Brexit, but the base case still remains. Article 50 will need to be extended. The FTSE Financial Index was up 0.37% to 656.38 and down 1.57% from a year back. And the Royal Bank of Scotland, who reported this week, was up 2.44% to 247.50, but down 12.11% from last year. Its profits were up, and it also reported making big loans to companies to allow them to forward buy and hold goods ahead of Brexit. The RBS is still majority owned by the government following its bailout a decade ago. The euro-US dollar was up a little to 1.1296, down 9.34% from last year. And Deutsche Bank was up 4.94% to 7.65 euros, but still down 42.3% from this time last year. The Chinese yuan-US dollar ended at 0.1476, down 6.29% from a year back. The WTI oil was up 2.57% to 55.81, down 9.65% from last year. Gold reversed earlier losses following the huge retail sales miss and rose 0.83% to 1,324.75, down 5.43% over the year. Silver was up 1.46% to 15.75, down 7.78% over the past 12 months. And copper was up 1.51% to 281, down 14.22% annually. Finally, Bitcoin ended at 3,665.3, down 61.26% from the past year. It broke above the upper bound of a downside channel recently that was containing the price action since January the 14th. On top of that, the rally brought the price above the 3,500 mark, with the crypto hitting resistance near the key obstacle of 3,700 before retreating. And also, JP Morgan announced that they had become the first US bank to create and successfully test a digital coin, representing a fiat currency. This is quite the pivot, as many will recall the CEO Diamond's comments that Bitcoin was a fraud and any employee trading it would be fired for being stupid. JPM Coin will run on JP Morgan's own blockchain called Curorum. This is the very early stages for JP Morgan's digital coin, and initial goals are to accelerate corporate payments. And while cryptocurrency fans may love the announcement, this does not necessarily bode well for Bitcoin, as JP Morgan Coin could be the beginning of severe competition for the digital currency. Now that nearly 80% of S&P 500 companies have been reported, fourth quarter earnings season is largely in the rearview mirror. Analysts now see a profit increase of 16.2% for the quarter. But going forward, however, the outlook continues to worsen. First quarter earnings are currently seen falling by 0.5%, the first year-on-year decline since mid-2016. And in summary then, we continue to see considerable uncertainty both locally and internationally. And my own view is that the stock markets are overpriced at the moment and will adjust later in the year. And before I go, a reminder that our next live stream event is now scheduled for Tuesday the 19th of February at 8 p.m. Sydney time. Here is the link to the reminder. And you can ask a question live or send them in to me ahead of time by using my blog. The link is below. I look forward to seeing you there. And as always, if you like what you've seen here today, please share and like the post and add a comment or question. I read them all. And if you want to join the growing Bounders subscribers who receive alerts when we release new posts, do subscribe now by hitting that subscribe bell. And if you have already subscribed, many thanks. I really appreciate your support and participation. I'm Martin North, the Principal Analyst at Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you again next time.